the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, Jason Bond back with another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. Bobby Golden's here with me, naturally. And
Yo.
So we're actually recording this in the afternoon this week. We usually do it in the morning, so
Somebody had to go to Starkville.
Yeah, I had to go to Starkville. Bobby's a little flustered.
It happens this time of day. I'm, you know, kind of all over the place. So
it's nice outside, though. It's blue sky.
It's hot in this room.
It's hot in this room, but it was cool this morning. So
it was cool. That's probably why I'm hot now. I still have a fleece on midday.
41 was the – I left the house pretty early. 41's as low as it got in my truck. I didn't see any frost.
Well, I didn't see any frost on the ground, but if you looked at the north-facing slopes of the peaks of the roofs on Gerald Street, there was a little frost hanging up there. So that is what it is.
Yeah, it's still dark when I left. Time's going to change. It's weird. It's dark. I mean, pitch black dark almost at 6:30.
I think you got another week before the government says set your clocks back.
To normal time, though.
Normal time.
That's normal time that we're going to. We're on daylight savings now.
That's right. Well, you know, when I got to work this morning, first off the bat, we started talking about fertilizers. I had a producer and one of his retailers come in, and we did that and talked on the phone to a lot of guys the last several weeks. So I think we're going to start the topic today of talking a little bit about fall fertility and how we need to approach fertilization schedule and budgets moving into the 2019 cropping season.
We mentioned this a few weeks ago when we talked about fall herbicide use and mentioned the fall fertilization too. But to me, that has been several weeks ago, and in a lot of ways the game has changed a little bit. I mean, the weather has just continued to sit on us in a lot of places. So, you know, some of the discussion we had at that time, Bobby, has that changed much?
Maybe a little bit has changed, because you got people with a lot tighter wallets now after enduring all these heavy hits on damage and basis and just trying to get rid of their beans. So I think you said I was flustered a while ago because it's afternoon. I think there's a lot of people out there flustered, not knowing what to do because they don't know where to spend money right now.
Yeah, and then the herbicide calls, man, have been, you know, next to none. I talked to one guy this morning about some Johnson grass, but, you know, compared with other years, you know, I ordinarily would have gotten a lot more calls about fall herbicides by now. And now the crop's out, you know, so we had mentioned a few weeks ago when we talked about it that, you know, guys were, you know, the priority was getting the crop out, and we still got some stuff in the field, especially cotton. But for the most part, the crop's out, and you know, we're thinking about next year in a lot of times. So it's kind of frustrating. Naturally, herbicides is one thing that you can cut out, but I think that, you know, the message you've been sending for the last few years is that fall fertilization is not necessarily something that we want to cut.
No, I don't think we want to cut it out completely. We may can cut back, and we'll get into that a little later, but cutting out completely probably not going to serve us well in many of the scenarios we find ourselves in the Delta. So first off, you got to think of, what are my yields? Okay, so have I been cutting really good yields? Have I been picking really good yields the last several years? So that's the first piece of information we need to know when we start talking about fertilization. And the second probably is, have I been soil sampling, or how long have I been on the soil sampling schedule?
And hopefully, you know, most people are on some semi-regular soil testing schedule. I know you've got numbers, you know, that kind of suggest that we're trending up on soil testing, the number of fields, you know, based on the number of samples. Just assuming that you are on some semi-regular soil testing schedule, you know, what is your recommendation talking to people about fall fertilization?
Well, I guess, you know, to you said it, we had some numbers. It looks like about a quarter to a third of the ground in this Delta area is sampled at least every 3 years. Okay.
To me, that seems like a pretty good number, man. I mean, considering the number of acres and the number of farms that we have, and the fact that you're not necessarily soil sampling every acre of your farm every year or even every other year. That seemed, you know, a third seems like a pretty good percentage.
Yeah, that's a good percentage, but what's probably a poorer percentage is if you believe USDA numbers, only a third of the producers in the state are putting out fertilizer. And when I say fertilizer, I mean P and K, fertilizers other than nitrogen. So if we have, and I guess backwards a couple of years ago, we did a soybean survey that said somewhere in upwards of 70% of soybean producers were soil sampling, but only a third of them are applying fertilizer.
So which number's accurate?
The numbers don't make sense. I feel like probably the more accurate number is the number of acres we're getting soil sampled a year. So what we got to remember is just because we soil sample doesn't mean we're going to apply fertilizer.
Yeah, because right? That sample may not call for, I mean, it may be as simple as that.
That's right. That's right. So I guess this time of year, the biggest thing that I'm talking about and reminding people is be cognizant of your nutrient removal because we're growing really good yields the last several years in the Delta. And if we are electing not to fertilize our soils, we can ruin a good piece of soil really quick by not at least trying to maintain it to some extent in that medium level.
All right, so nutrient removal, what kind of numbers are we talking about there? You know, put it in numbers folks can understand, you know, from fertilizer.
All right, so if you're talking about soybeans, which is our biggest nutrient hog in the Delta that we grow, and you grow a 60 bushel soybean crop, it's going to remove about 85 units of K2O. Okay, so what
is
that?
Which is potash.
That's right.
You get on me for herbicide name, so K2O, that's potash.
That's right. So if you want to put that in potash, so 84 units of potash ends up being 140 pounds of muriate of potash to actually apply and make that up. Now,
which is 0060, right?
Is 0060. Man, somebody did well in school over there. I've been listening when I'm in the truck on the phone.
I listen.
So, you know, we're removing the equivalent of 140 pounds of muriate of potash in a 60 bushel bean crop. That's a lot of fertilizer, and not many people think about when they tote those beans off the field that we're removing actually dollars in fertilizer, right? So you look at, you know, what fertilizer cost, and 140 pounds of muriate an acre, right? So that's an acre. And current prices today, somewhere in between that $325 and $370 a ton. Don't take many 60 bushel soybean acres to hit a ton of fertilizer.
You're saying soybeans are the nutrient hog. And I would just, you know, my mind it would seem corn would be just from the plant, you know, being such a big, robust plant and having all that biomass. And I know a lot of the biomass is going back on the field, but I would have just suspected that corn would have been the bigger remover.
Well, corn and rice remove slightly less potassium than soybeans, but you're right. Because they remove less per unit of grain, more of it's in the straw. And we're going to return most of that back to the field. And even if we elect to burn that corn and soybean or corn and rice stubble, it's going to remain in the field as ash. And as long as we don't get a hard rain, most of it's going to be there.
Or a big wind. I've heard you talk about the wind, too, blowing the ash.
Right. And you know, the vortex in a fire, and it picks up and throws the ash on somebody else's field, and you just fertilize theirs with them for free. But back to what we've been talking about is most of the people that are soil sampling in the state are doing some form of precision soil sampling, grid sampling or Varis sampling or something of that nature, where they've got this nice big pretty map showing what's going on their farm. And there's a couple things with those maps that I don't like, and we were talking this morning a little bit about that. Is, you know, you look at a yield monitor, you look at a soil test map, they go from red to green. Obviously green's good, red's bad. Well, when you're looking at a lot of as-applied maps, those numbers on the bottom change that are associated with red to green, okay? So depending on your fertilizer recommendation for a specific field, we've got to show variation in color But I guess what I'm trying to say is if you look at a soil test report, red's not always red and green's not always green.
So we could have a lot of red on a map for a soil test, but that being of, say, the moderate category, it wouldn't necessarily be in the low category like you would see red on a yield map where you know red's bad.
Well, on an as-applied map.
Yeah, okay. And that's what I meant.
And I guess, so there's, then that's two distinct differences we need to talk about. The physical soil test map, which shows your nutrient availability index in that field, is completely different than an as-applied map that would be used for your rate controller to put the fertilizer out.
Which would
out.
Be the prescription, basically.
Right. So on those prescription maps, you know, this prescription for this farm, the red might be 130 units of potash, and on another it might be 230. But just because we're showing color variations, I guess that all leads me to the point that I try to tell every producer that sits in my office, we can draw you a map with pretty colors, but don't look at the colors. Look at the hard numbers. Because if we look at those hard numbers, then we know what we're dealing with.
Yeah, because what you just described was almost 100% difference. And if you're talking about 300, you know, whatever price per unit you quoted a little while ago, that gets in some big dollars. What about cotton? Where does it factor in?
Cotton generally moves the least amount of nutrients of any crop we grow. Simply because it's a tree.
Right.
You've heard me say that our annual crops make babies, as many as they can, because they don't know if they're going to be alive next year. Well, cotton knows it's going to be alive next year, so.
Or it's hedging, thinking it's going to be alive next year.
Well, if we don't get a heavy frost, it might be.
Right.
But so just that fundamental shift, and not to borrow a line from a Jay Mahaffey, but if y'all have heard Jay talk, he gives a talk talking about think like a cotton plant. Well, our annual crops in cotton, which is technically a perennial, think completely different when it comes to nutrient management.
We've talked about potash or potassium, and that's obviously a priority. What other nutrients are we thinking about during this fall time frame?
Mainly in the fall time frame, we're wanting to think about potash and phosphate. And we get a lot of calls all the time talking about, well, you know, do I put my potash out in the fall or spring? And we're going to look at that based on CEC and probably the amount of magnesium that's in the soil. With phosphorus, we tend to can go out in the fall on that. On most places, we do have some data with rice saying that if our pH is above 7.5, we probably need to move that phosphate to the spring.
Bobby, we've talked about potassium, we've talked about phosphorus, we've talked about our common crops that we grow. So I just want to do a little, you know, not really rapid fire, but just pose some scenarios to you. Because what I hear you saying, or what I'm getting from what you're saying, is that it's really all over the board. There's just a ton of variables that play into making these decisions. Same way it is in my world, you know, making decision of what product to use and when and how much and if you even use it, especially in this fall application window. So soybeans is our nutrient hog. Soybeans is also right now our primary crop in the Delta. You know, if I'm a primary soybean producer, and, you know, maybe I've got some continuous soybean acres, and maybe I rotate, I don't know, 30-40% of my ground with corn. So I've got continuous soybeans. I've got a soybean-corn rotation. Middle of the road, you know, Delta soil texture, not really, really sandy, and maybe not really, really heavy clay either. You know, just the proverbial mixed ground. Where am I prioritizing my fertilization for the fall in 2018?
I'd probably put most of it in that scenario that you described into potash. So, you know, we know that with tight budgets, people are cutting back and they may not be able to maintain their build and maintain program that they've been doing for 3 or 4 years. So I would say if you've been religiously following the recommendations for the last 3 to 4 years, and you've been on a build and maintain program, this year you may can cut back a little bit to basically what our data says is if you're going to put a soybean plant in the ground, that soybean plant will make everything it needs to make as long as you give it at least 90 units of potash. Okay. So you could cut back to that. All right. And where I would do the cuts is if you look at a lot of that ground and it says you need an over an abundance of phosphorus, most all of our data suggests that 50 to 60 units of phosphorus, and in some cases, you know, down to 45, is all the phosphorus you need to grow a soybean plant. So what we got to remember when we look at that stuff is we can't base it 100% on crop removal, because if we supplied all the nutrients we're going to remove with fertilizer, we'd be on a losing game and never be able to afford that, right? So we are getting something from our soil. You know, if you have to cut back, that's kind of those levels to cut back. And I guess what I would say is if you can't afford your fertilizer bill, you need to think about, all right, I'm going to take money from phosphate and put it into potash in the scenario you described.
So we could cut back a little bit more on the phosphorus in the interest of making sure that that plant has everything it needs for potassium.
That's right. That's what I think on the scenario that you described, if it was mine, I would do.
Okay. Would that be across the board on the continuous soybean and the acre that's rotated with corn?
On the acre that's rotated with corn, I would probably at least put out 60 units of phosphorus.
Coming out of corn into soybean going, for 2019.
No, going into corn out of soybeans.
Corn for 2019.
Going into soybeans, you got a little wiggle room where you could bump that phosphorus down. But, you know, if you look at all of our data that we've generated, I think 36 plus site years of it, phosphorus requirements are a little greater on corn than soybeans. And the potash requirement is about equal in uptake. Doesn't mean removal is equal, but uptake is about equal.
All right, next scenario. Different farm, heavy clay soil, 50-50 rotation rice and soybean. So tell me what I'm going to do on the fields that are coming out of rice into soybeans, and then second of all, the fields coming out of soybeans that'll be rice next year.
All right, on that heavy ground, generally, and I say generally, on that heavy ground, our potash is sufficient enough that we can use a maintenance rate. Okay, But it's not always. And the other thing we have to contend for on those soils is some of this really high magnesium. So I would say in that scenario, you know, if you're talking about soil test numbers in the 400 to 500 pounds, maintenance rate of potash would suffice. Now, that's on 100% buckshot Sharkey clay. As you start moving back to that mixed ground, soybean is going to look like soybean on light ground, and rice is going to look like corn. Rice actually will pull a little bit more potassium than corn. But I think the key in all of that is having a soil test and knowing where your levels are. Right, so we can get by maybe with a little less potash on that heavy ground, but that may be where we need to juice our phosphorus up a little bit more. And most of that heavy ground is creeping up in the high pH, and based on our rice data, we're going to need to probably think about moving that phosphorus to the springtime to get the best bang for our buck out of it.
Okay, and you had talked about timing a few weeks ago when we talked about. You know, fall fertilization, and I think you had mentioned that at the time, you know, get it where it's needed the most.
Well, it goes back to that 4R nutrient stewardship: the right place, right time, right source, and right rate.
So light soil, really low CEC, some cotton and soybean rotation, maybe some cotton and corn rotation, and then maybe continuous soybean. And I know that's a lot at once with some different scenarios, but the key, really light soil, low CEC, a variety of rotation schedules.
You know, in that situation, when you're talking about really light soils, that makes me think cotton ground. And when I'm thinking of cotton ground, I'm thinking of CECs of 12 or less, and that's where we kind of break down in this fall fertilization scheme, and I'd really like guys to move everything to the spring. Now, I know moving everything to the spring is logistically impossible. So maybe on that lightest ground you have, and especially something like cotton, where you're going to plant it later, you're not going to be breaking the doors down to get in there in March, let's move that potash application into the springtime, okay? Two fractions. One, on that very light CEC, we're not going to move it down in the profile, okay, because of lack of cation exchange capacity to hold that potassium on there. And two, it's going to spread that out a little bit. So we know that we've had a lot of issues with cotton going potash deficient in the last several years. And by moving that closer to when that plant needs it, it's hopefully going to be there for it.
Heavy soil, say, maybe not heavy sharky clay, but maybe sandy clay loam. So a little bit finer than mixed texture. And you, this scenario will be familiar to you because I was involved in this conversation last week. But new farm, growing cotton on a sandy clay loam, severe potash deficiency with little field history on what had gone on there previously other than driving down the road and seeing that we grew soybeans there for several years. How do you address that? Coming out of that cotton crop knowing that it was, the yield was probably influenced because of potash.
What am I going into this year?
It'll be probably back in cotton.
Back in cotton. Well, I would say now I'm going to play market prices and see when I can get the best bang for my buck out of fertilizer. With that little bit of heavy mixed ground, I'm probably going to put some potash out this fall just in case, we do want to plant that cotton in the middle of April, right, and go a little early. People tend to be going earlier in May now. So put some out this fall, and I'm going to split that application and give some to that crop once it gets up.
Okay. So after it, well, assuming that field goes into cotton in 2019 and you know that an application is going to be required, is there an appropriate timing or is it just when you can get it out?
I would say when you could get it out, preferably if you're going with something like a high clearance rig and you can get it out when that cotton's young or right before you plant and not mess up your rows. And then if you're still knocking those rows down, get it incorporated that way. I think that would suffice.
All right. So, Bobby, just to summarize, we went through a lot of scenarios, but just to leave people with the key points to take away, soybeans definitely need to be conscious of our soil test levels, particularly for potassium after a big crop, particularly after maybe a couple of big crops in a row. And you mentioned the price of potash and then haven't heard you speak a lot about these nutrients in the past. I know you talk about the high end of the price, like in 07, 08, when I think it was like $700 a ton. So, I mean, $350, definitely the current market, a commodity market, is, presenting some challenges for us. But our fertilizer bill is still not to the level where it was in previous years. So speak about that for a minute.
Right. And I'll throw that back in your court. If you look at most of our Mississippi State production budgets, the fertilizer budget and the herbicide budget kind of run hand in hand. They're anywhere between 18% and 22%, not including nitrogen. I don't know many people out there that would grow a crop without a herbicide input, but a lot of people out there elect to not put fertilizer. So if we start thinking about fertilizer as something that can make yield, okay, because right now I only know two things that make yield, and that's seed selection and fertilizer. When we start talking about herbicides and fungicides, they're called crop protection products for a reason.
That's right. Right.
So fertilizer and seed selection probably has the biggest impact on making yield for you. And using those crop protection products will have the impact of protecting what you made with your seed selection decision as well as your fertilizer management. One thing that I think we need to talk about that we haven't, and we'll probably put this on as a concluder, so to speak, is it seemed to be the old maintenance application was a 0-40-60. Didn't matter what crop we were growing, but we were going to put out at least 40 units of phosphate and at least 60 units of potash. Well, today, we're probably the similar in the phosphate, probably could bump that up to 60, but I think we'd really need to be running as a maintenance application at 0-60-80, and that's going to take care of a lot of these high-yielding crops. And maybe we'll come back on a next episode and talk about sulfur, not to leave y'all hanging. But I think sulfur is a key, especially on some of our lighter ground. We've been seeing it pop up a lot. And in this grain-based system, sulfur is going to take us to the next level if we're lacking a little bit on our soybean and corn production.
All right. You got any more closing thoughts, or you still in the brain fog?
I'm ready for it to dry up.
It's getting there. There's some tractors running between here and Greenwood. Not a lot.
But there's a lot of guys sitting still, too. I talked to a guy this morning that said he couldn't do anything because he couldn't tear down his rice levees. And, man, I feel for those guys right there that are trying to struggle and get everything worked back up to go into beans. And they got a big mound of dirt out there they can't do nothing with.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's guys pulling mud on some cotton pickers as well. We're going to jump off, but naturally, if you got any more questions, Bobby can answer them. And if you need us to come look at something, we're always more than willing to do that.
Appreciate y'all guys for listening one more time.
Thanks.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.